Hello there, and welcome to another episode of the Civic Tech in Africa podcast. Thank you for joining us, as always. In today's episode, we'll be talking about misinformation and disinformation on the internet and social media platforms and how that's sort of affecting or has an impact on the election process. Because during the election process, you know, these campaigns can be quite amplified. And it's almost certain that most users have come across some sort of misinformation or disinformation. These tactics sometimes used by political parties and their supporters in their bid to win elections. So we need to talk about that and sort of the role of social media platforms in combating these campaigns. In today's episode, we'll be looking at the threats of mis and disinformation on the democratic process and whether or not we can avoid and combat such campaigns. But before we begin, please take some time to rate and review our podcast. Feel free to leave us comments or questions wherever you're listening to this podcast. While you do that, we'll take a short break. Welcome back. Joining us for this episode is Kavisha Pillay, who is the founder of the initiative Campaign on Digital Ethics. CODE is a nonprofit dedicated to exploring the critical nexus of technology, human rights, and democracy. CODE is an initiative that aims to empower individuals to take control of their digital lives. Kavisha, of course, is not new to this podcast. She is a social justice activist and the executive director of the Campaign on Digital Ethics. Kavisha has a background spanning over a decade in good governance and anti-corruption and continues to work to support whistleblowers as well as pioneer research and data solutions aimed at preventing corruption. I'm excited to have you join us again, Kavisha. Welcome.
Hi, Nati. It's so great to be back with you.
I'm so happy that you joined us again. You've started a new initiative, CODE, and I'm very excited to talk about that. Can you tell us a little bit about that platform and why you got started with it?
Yeah, so CODE is a brand new organization in the human rights space in South Africa. And we, as you mentioned in the introduction, we're looking at this critical nexus of this convergence of democracy, technology, and human rights. And you know, we've been born in this year of global democracy where like half of the world's population is going to the polls to elect people to different levels of their government. And it's quite an opportune time for organizations like CODE and others, because we now at this moment where technology and these digital communications platforms that we're using has quite an interesting impact on democracy and electoral processes. And we've seen through, you know, various examples, be it, you know, the election of Donald Trump in 2016 or the Brexit vote in the UK or India's recent elections, as well as in Brazil and the Philippines, but how social media in particular can be used to very much polarize our societies, but also where a lot of disinformation can be used in order to persuade people to vote or not vote in particular ways. And with scandals like Cambridge Analytica, where users' data was then scraped and then sold off to third parties, and politicians were then able to use that data in order to micro-target people with information that may appeal to their biases or play on their fears. You know, we now realize that we are in a different moment in terms of how elections are run. So false information and disinformation is not a new phenomenon. I mean, propaganda has existed for centuries, and politicians will do whatever they can and tell you whatever they, you know, they will tell you a lot of things in order to persuade you to vote in particular ways. But I do think with this type of technology and the sophisticated technology that presently occupies our time and that we are using on a more consistent basis, it is creating a lot of danger in terms of locking people into echo chambers, feeding them with information that may not be true in order to persuade them to vote in particular ways. So that's one of the things that CODE focuses on, not just the sort of, you know, we see disinformation campaigns or acts of disinformation as a byproduct of a system that allows for this to thrive. So social media companies, basically, they use recommendation systems or algorithms that feed you information that they think you'd be interested in based on content that you've liked or that you've engaged on and interacted with. And these algorithms, you know, are designed to keep you scrolling. So that's how they make their money, is because they keep your attention. And then by keeping your attention, you can then be fed with ads or different types of content that is monetized. And it's these types of environments and these types of systems that have now allowed for rampant disinformation campaigns to thrive, because it is recommending information to you, which it thinks that you may be interested in, even if that information is incorrect. So Code is looking at how these platforms should be changing in terms of ensuring that we don't get locked into our echo chambers or little bubbles where everybody agrees with what we think, but also that the types of disinformation that has been floating on social media is actually that these companies are taking more proactive steps to not allow it to thrive. So that's in the one part of it, is just looking at social media and disinformation. We're also quite concerned about how technology is being developed, especially in the context of AI right now, because we're in a bit of an AI arms race where every day there's been a new development by a different company. It's quite hard to keep up with the new releases from different companies and so on. But I think within this context of this arms race where everybody's trying to get a product out, you know, it's not necessarily being built with the human rights framework in mind or with an ethical framework in mind. So a lot of these products should still be in their testing phases because they still contain lots of biases, a lot of things that may discriminate against some groups. And basically what Code is saying is that these types of technologies should be built with a human rights framework in mind. They should be ethical. They should be used to enable and strengthen democracies and societies, and should never actually be used to further disenfranchise or oppress people or polarize people in any way. And right. At this point, I think all of those guardrails don't necessarily exist.
If I am a developer right now and I'm looking to develop an application, and all of them now are sort of have AI embedded in them, right? What should I be looking out for as somebody who's interested in making sure that I'm developing this in a very ethical way? What should I be looking out for as somebody who's developing an application like that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting question, because I don't think there is something that we can put down in stone to say this is the right way to build AI, because this technology keeps innovating and developing on a very fast basis. But I do think that there's principles that we should hold dear, and as tech developers, always go back to our own types of Hippocratic oaths in a way,
right,
where this technology should never bring harm to anybody else, that the data that you're using to train the AI on contains information that's not going to promote unintended biases. I mean, I know that for a lot of people who are developing AI and so on, that it's their product and there's, you know, intellectual property and so on. But I also think that we need to be able to make sure that we are transparent about the data that we're using to train these machines. I want to know why, you know, I'm getting certain types of responses.
Right.
In comparison to other people, for example. So there's a transparency to it, but there's also, I think, an accountability part. So if your model is producing something that is harmful, that you are addressing that in a transparent way, that you're acknowledging that, and that you're also willing to fix and remedy that as opposed to putting profit over people. There's certain principles that we should be basing this development of AI, especially if it's for like broad-based civic use.
Do you know if there's any actual frameworks that, you know, particularly on the African continent, if there are any policies that sort of guard against people developing, you know, applications in an unethical way?
No, unfortunately not. I think we're still going to have to catch up a bit. You know, the EU has an AI Act, which seems to be quite progressive. And I think it is a model for other countries to adopt. On the continent, I think Egypt has come up with a few proposals on how AI should be developed. And I know that it is a conversation that's happening within the African Union. But from a country perspective, to try and legislate or create policies around this, I think is going to be tricky. Just because trying to understand the nature of AI and where it is going to go to in the future, nobody really has a crystal ball. So you don't want to create policy that would limit innovators. But on the other hand, you also need to put up these guardrails to make sure that the people who are developing these types of technologies are operating within a framework that is in line with our constitution, that is in line with our Bill of Rights. So at the moment, South Africa doesn't have these policies. I do think there's an AI discussion document that was put out by the government recently. That discussion document touches on, but on a very sort of limited basis, about the sort of ethics of building AI. It's more about how AI can be used and deployed in different sectors in order to improve service delivery, in order to how are children going to learn coding and so on, so that they can operate within this new world of technology. But it's not, there hasn't been a lot of discussions, at least from my perspective, about how we can build AI in a progressive way. Because, you know, the thing now is that we're never going to put the genie back into the bottle. AI is here to stay. And even though it may be a bit scary, it is going to sort of upend a few things. And, you know, there may be some jobs that may be at risk of this. We have to get ahead of the curve, and we have to say, instead of waiting for some mass violations to take place, that we are having coordinated conversations about the types of framework that we think should be put in place when people are developing this. And this is why, you know, the Civic Tech Innovation Network, which I think is absolutely fantastic and have always been a fan of, you know, one of the roles that the CTIN can play in is that you're bringing together these tech developers from across the continent. And what is, you know, our collective responsibility now that we understand the dangers of technology and how it can be used to harm people? What is this collective responsibility and pledge that we are making? But how are we going to use AI and build other tech, but within a framework that is about promoting and protecting rights and not about destabilizing our societies further?
And you've written a little bit about this on your website, the impact of AI, right? And you talked about deepfakes being used, for instance, in our own elections. And I think we made the example about, you know, Donald Trump endorsing Jacob Zuma for, you know, Jacob Zuma's party. And I'm thinking about how we can spot disinformation. How can we equip people to be better placed to understand when something is disinformation? Because there are some people who are still unable to spot that, like, that doesn't seem real. Do we have any guidelines for people like me? We're trying to understand, okay, is this real or not?
You know, the thing is that because this technology is becoming more and more sophisticated, it does become harder to tell whether something is true or not true. Don't feel too bad if you're not able to immediately point out that this is a fake story or this video is not real. I think, you know, digital literacy is no longer just a skill, but I think a necessity that anybody who is using a digital platform, you know, from social media to Uber or any, you know, like Airbnb or Teams or whatever platforms you're using, Google Meet, Google Docs, you know, we're on these digital platforms all the time. We don't actually understand how our data is being collected, you know, potentially mined and sold off to other people who are then targeting us with different adverts, et cetera, et cetera. We're not necessarily on social media platforms. We don't understand how the algorithms work and why we're seeing certain information and so on. And that's why I'm saying, because a lot of our lives, especially post-COVID, there's this heightened use of technology that's happening, that each one of us has to take personal responsibility of understanding the apps that we use, how our devices work, how our data is being collected, why we are seeing certain things that we're seeing. And this type of learning, again, is not like, okay, I'm going to do one course and now I figured it out. It's a consistent thing because this technology is keep improving. So whilst we do need the tech companies to do their job to not cause harm, and we do need government to create proper progressive regulation, as users of platforms, we also have a role in ensuring that we're contributing towards a safer digital world. So to your question about disinformation, you know, with the Trump videos and some of the videos that we've been seeing, like there was a video from the rapper Eminem who was endorsing the EFF. And then there was another video from Joe Biden who said that you must vote for the MK party because the ANC has failed people, etc. You know, those videos, fortunately for us, you can see are fake because it's these sort of, even though they're deep fakes, they're cheap fakes. So you can see that, like, the sound and the mouthing of the words is, you know, not in sync with each other. And you can also just, you know, do a quick search. Well, why would Donald Trump, you know, support this? Or why would Eminem support the EFF? Right. So those ones are, like, you know, a bit more easier to spot. But there's other types of disinformation that becomes a lot more difficult, which needs to make us critically think about the information that we're receiving. So, you know, you are going to have to go and do a search to see, well, has this been reported elsewhere? You are going to have to go and do a search to see, well, who is the author of this? Can you pinpoint where this information is coming from? You are going to have to do a bit of verification and so on. And these are things that, I guess, in this time of where attention spans are really short and where we, you know, we share things immediately, it actually forces you to stop and verify before you amplify information.
Right.
These are skills that I think all of us are going to have to develop, because I think sometimes inadvertently we can contribute towards the misinformation crisis by sharing things without actually verifying that this is true.
I'm slightly worried about the responsibility being on us, you know, that we need to be the ones having all the literacy in the world to spot. You need to know the context of, because you're saying this, like, you need to know why somebody is saying the thing, right? And sometimes you need to understand the context from that person is saying the thing, right? That's why now I need to read up on Joe Biden and his policies and why he wouldn't be, you know, endorsing a certain party in South Africa. That seems like a lot of work. Because I understand that a lot of people don't have the capacity or the willingness to educate themselves on this topic, I sort of feel like somebody else should be responsible for that, right? And I think we've spoken about policies earlier, about whether they are frameworks in the country or on the continent. And from what you're saying, there currently isn't any frameworks that are guarding against that. Is there a way that we can really fight disinformation and sort of eradicate it? Because I know that, you know, other, you know, social media apps, they have some disclaimer. So speaking against whatever the post says, right? And I think that's sort of, that's helpful. But is there a, in your mind, is there a way that we can totally put a lid on disinformation and misinformation?
It is possible, but it is going to require this all of society approach. I know it feels like a lot of work for us to go and verify and before we share things, or, you know, like go and see whether or not this is a real video or a fake video. But we have a role to play in ensuring a safer digital world. So all of this is possible, but everybody has a role. So the role of tech companies is that tech companies and the social media companies in particular have to find ways to change their recommendation systems and their algorithms that does not amplify disinformation. And they need to take those proactive steps to doing that, to ensure that their platforms are actually safe and that their platforms aren't peddling lies and mistruths, and they're not putting profit in advertising and, you know, sort of work playing in this attention economy over the real world impacts of what disinformation can do. I mean, Nati, you and I would have been using social media now perhaps for more than half our lives. You know, from like the very early days of like Mixit and all of those types of platforms, you know, we've grown a long way, you know, and it's not just about your auntie sending you a WhatsApp that says, if you don't forward this to 7 people, your WhatsApp is going to shut down at midnight. You know, we've seen the real world consequences of disinformation, be it during the pandemic and, you know, disinformation around mask wearing or around vaccinations, or we've seen it during, you know, South Africa during the 2021 July riots and how that had real world consequences and impact on people losing their lives and companies and, you know, just lots of insecurity in the country at that time. And it's becoming heightened because it's no longer conversations that happen online, stay online and doesn't actually, you know, occur in the real physical world. You know, these lines have now been blurred. So tech companies have to take responsibility for their role in creating this crisis that we're in, and to then be able to, you know, develop safer platforms. Government has to develop progressive regulation. I say progressive because there are spaces where governments can regulate and create laws around disinformation that then can be used to shut down opposition voices and then can be used, you know, sort of by authoritarian states. So, for example, if I was critical about the current administration in South Africa and we had those types of laws, they could easily say, well, you're spreading disinformation off to jail. So how do we create policies that still respect your fundamental right to freedom of speech and expression, but also then put consequences of people who are creating disinformation? So there's a difference between dis and misinformation. Not sure if the audience is completely aware of this, but disinformation is content that is intentionally created to deceive and cause harm, whereas misinformation is when you or I, without actually knowing that the content contains lies, shares that content. So you don't want to prosecute somebody who shared misinformation because they weren't actually aware of this. But right. the originators of that content, they should, you know, be held to account in some way.
Right.
So you need that type. And you also need governments to take a more proactive stance against, these types of platforms that are enabling the harm, where these platforms are also then held accountable. Because the tech industry and the social media industry is perhaps one of the only industries in the world right now that is completely unregulated. Mm-hmm. And that's very scary. And then it is the part of me and you and other people in our society using the platform, and what role do we play in ensuring that we're not contributing towards the spread of lies and contributing towards this polarization that's taking place, and that we're actively trying to ensure that the information ecosystem is healthy and robust. It's not to say that, you know, we can't debate and can't engage. If you have a view and I have a view, you know, it doesn't mean we shouldn't be using our platforms for that and to share information. But where, you know, there are outright lies being used to make a point or to debate one another, you know, that needs to come to an end. So we all have a role to play in this, and it may be annoying and it may sort of feel like it's going to take a lot, but I think that it is important. If you think about the pandemic, you know, we had a small role of just wearing a mask and washing your hands, and we have to sort of take that type of mindset, and social distancing, we have to take that type of mindset into this fight as well if we want to make sure that we're stopping the spread of disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking just now that we gain something by being a very connected world, right? And everybody can see whatever they want, whenever they want, do whatever they want. But I think having no authority on information, mm-hmm. we've lost something, right? Mm-hmm. And some people can say, I mean, there's the positives to it, right? That there's nobody who's just in charge of information. But I think the press sort of played a very key role, I think, before our time, I suppose. They were the ones who shared all the information in the world, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to know anything, you go mm-hmm. to a newspaper, and that would be the facts, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody else would dispute those facts. And I think, though, even to this day, the free press has a role to play. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes what I see on, you know, in newspapers is sort of people peddling what's being said on social media, for instance. It's like, you're supposed to be an authority on information, right? And you're still relying on social media and sort of spreading these ideas that are coming from social media. I don't know if you have any thoughts on the value of the free press as a way to keep us informed and giving us the right information, as opposed to relying on social media and everybody's opinion about stuff. And you've spoken about like how the pandemic, for instance, we had one thing too. People didn't believe that we needed to use masks as a way mm. to, you know, like, because a lot of other people were peddling different information mm. about, mm. you know, the World Health Organization is saying one thing, but other people who are supposed experts are saying a different thing. Mm. And that's the thing for me. It's like we lack authority on certain subjects now because everybody has an opinion. Yeah. And I think that's where the press is very important, right? I don't know what you think about that.
Definitely. And I think I'm going to show a little bit of bias here because I studied journalism, and I fundamentally believe that good journalism is potentially one of the antidotes to the levels of disinformation that we're seeing right now. Mm. And I was a journalism student when we were starting to see the power of these tools and these mediums. So I was finally a journalism student, and, you know, Marikana happened. And previously, you'd have to be by your radio or had to, you know, be watching TV. And I just remember seeing the tweets coming through live about miners being shot down. I was also, you know, in my final year when the Arab Spring happened, and how social media in these types of authoritarian states, how social media was being used to organize, progressively organize. And I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. This is just like democracy is just going to get better. And I really did drink that Kool-Aid for a good few years because I knew, I was like, well, you know, people are going to get access to information and we're going to be able to communicate with each other, and people who didn't necessarily have a platform will be able to be given a voice, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's still parts of it that are true. And I don't think that, you know, it's all completely lost and gone. But coming from this time where social media was seen as something that could strengthen and enable democracy, we're seeing how it can destabilize democracy. Coming from a thinking and a space of where information was power, you know, you sort of, as an activist, the sort of the premise is if you give people information, they'll be able to act in that information and hold people accountable. You know, that's how it goes. We're now at a time where disinformation is power. So people can be given the wrong information, act in that information, and then you're sort of sitting in the state that we're sitting in right now, not just in South Africa, but across the world. And you know, this is where I think good journalism comes in, because I think we need to start to build centers of trust in information again. Now, Donald Trump really did a number about fake news media, because I think that so much of distrust in media institutions. And to be honest, I sometimes have that feeling too. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily read certain publications because I have a view that, oh, they're only peddling this particular point. And because I disagree with them, I'm going to go read my news here. I can literally curate the information, you know, that I want to read that suits my own biases. And I constantly have to check myself and have to say, well, just because these people believe in a different economic policy that I believe in, you know, I should actually go and engage with that other point of view. I shouldn't just sort of lock myself into these spaces. So I think part of what the media needs to do is try and build trust again.
Right.
And I think because of this distrust in media right now, this is why people feel like, okay, I'm rather going to go and get my information from other sources and from sources I agree with, you know, sources that I know will, you know, tick all of my boxes. Mm. And this is the state that we're in right now, is that you can literally mute anybody or any idea that goes against what you think.
True. Now, you spoke about good journalism, and I think there's a phrase going around now about how good journalism is hidden behind paywalls.
Mm.
Literally, if I want to know anything about like this election, I will go to an online publication and there's a paywall, right? And I can't access that anymore. And I'm thinking about how the stuff that you get for free is stuff that, here's what somebody said on social media. Mm-hmm. Have you been on TikTok lately? Here's the latest trend, right? But the stuff that's detailed and very important is behind paywalls. I understand that publications have to make money, but I don't know if we're worse off because of that.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. So the thing is that on the one hand, in order to maintain good standards of journalism, we need to make sure that journalists are paid well and that these organizations have the funds to do the work that they need to do, because it is quite resource intensive. So on the one hand, yes, paying for quality journalism shouldn't be a bad thing. But most people in the country can't afford to pay for quality journalism. So they are going to rely on the free sources. And what's going to happen is that more people will rely on information that's not credible, that comes from social media, as opposed to information that comes from journalism. So we need to find ways to better fund journalism, because journalism is a public good. It's absolutely necessary and essential for the democracy.
Yep.
And trying to find ways to get this industry to be able to get money in order to do its job so that people, more people can have access to information, I think is, you know, one of the sort of serious issues that all of us need to be concerned about. But I do think, you know, I was for a long time not really a fan of paying for things and get really frustrated in terms of paywalls and so on. But because I do have, I am in a position where I can afford to contribute towards the sector and get my journalism, I've, you know, taken a step to do so. But I completely understand that most people aren't in that situation. So it's also a thing on media houses to, like, what extent of this information are you understanding is in the public interest and is, you know, that the public has to be made aware of, that you can't hide that behind a paywall. So, yeah, it's a sort of massive dilemma that I think, you know, we all need to grapple with and find a way through, because we do need good journalism to counter the levels of disinformation that we're seeing.
Yeah, I suppose it's on media outlets to find the balance in between, you know, what we can hide behind a paywall and what we can share. Because it's all this like slapstick stuff that's on that's available for free. The good stuff is hidden. That's my frustration anyway.
Yeah.
Let's talk about code and what you're up to. What next?
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, just in this conversation, there's so many things that we've touched on. So post the elections, there's an opportunity for code to actually really get into finding ways of contributing towards policy discussions in South Africa around potential regulation of AI in terms of how we're understanding disinformation and how we're wanting to take this forward, because there's no sort of regulations, or there's very few sort of regulations at this point. There's no regulations at this point. So there's an opportunity there to work with other stakeholders and like-minded organizations. Quite a bit of research that we are going to be undertaking. So one of the things that I'm particularly sort of building a passion towards right now is just trying to understand what AI is going to do to the job market and what that means from a taxation perspective.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. Great talking to you again. And to our audience, thank you so much for sticking with us until now. Please stay on for our next segment, which is What in the Civic Tech? We'll be back right after this. School of Governance is hosting the International Conference on Theory and Practice of Electronic Governance. The gathering, which was first conceived in 2007, is an annual gathering that brings together academia, governments, international organizations, civil society, and industry to share the latest insights and experiences in the theory and practice of digital governance. This year, the conference will be hosted by South Africa through the Wits School of Governance and the South African National Department of Public Services and Administration under the theme Trust and Ethical Digital Governance for the World We Want. Conference will be taking place between the 1st and 4th of October in Pretoria, South Africa. Dr. Takeshi Karurisabina, the coordinator of the Tarisha Center at the Wits School of Governance, tells us more about the conference.
We were very, very excited to find out earlier this year that South Africa has been successful in its bid to host the 2024 ICEGOV conference. This is a conference of hundreds of people who come from around the world, academics, government actors, industry actors, to really talk about how we transform governance and public service delivery through digital platforms, digital technologies. South Africa will be the focus of e-government conversations globally. We anticipate seeing this as an Africa-wide event, so Africa hosting the world, and WITS is at the very center of that in partnership with the Department of Public Service and Administration.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. Don't forget to rate and review us. Until next time, goodbye.